A reward of its weight in gold, says Plutarch, had been offered for this trophy, and its captor, acting in the true spirit as a champion of big business, filled the brain case with lead on its way to the scales. In spite of these prompt, firm measures, the Senate wasn't to enjoy the benefits of peace and the advantages of the control of the imperial resources for long. Within 10 years, the people were in revolt again. In 118 BC, the throne of Numidia, the semi-barbaric kingdom that had arisen in North Africa upon the ruins of the civilized Carthaginian power, was seized by a certain able Jugurtha, who had served with the Roman armies in Spain and had a knowledge of the Roman character. He provoked the military intervention of Rome. But the Romans found that their military power, under a senate of financiers and landlords, was very different from what it had been even in the days of the younger Scipio Africanus. Jugurtha bought over the commissioners sent out to watch him, the senators charged with their prosecution, and the generals in command against him. There's a mistaken Roman proverb, pecunia non olet, money does not stink, for the money of Jugurtha stank even in Rome. There was an angry agitation, and a capable soldier of lowly origin, Marius, was carried to the consulship in 107 BC on the wave of popular indignation. Marius made no attempt on the model of the Gracchi to restore the backbone of the army by rehabilitating the yeoman class. He was a professional soldier with a high standard of efficiency and a disposition to take short cuts. He simply raised troops from among the poor, whether countrymen or townsmen, paid them well, disciplined them thoroughly, and in 106 BC ended the 7 years' war with Jugurtha by bringing that chieftain in chains to Rome. It didn't occur to anybody that, incidentally, Marius had also created a professional army with no interest to hold it together but its pay. He then held on to the consulship more or less illegally for several years, and in 102 and 101 BC repelled a threatening move of the Germans, who thus appear in our history for the first time, who were raiding through Gaul towards Italy. He gained 2 victories, one on Italian soil. He was hailed as the saviour of his country, a second Camillus, in 100 BC. The social tensions of the time mocked that comparison with Camillus. The Senate, benefited by the greater energy in foreign affairs and the increased military efficiency that Marius had introduced. But the sullen, shapeless discontent of the mass of the people was still seeking some effective outlet. The rich grew richer and the poor poorer. It was impossible to stifle the consequences of that process forever by political trickery. The Italian people were still unenfranchised. 2 extreme democratic leaders, Saturninus and Glaucia, were assassinated, but that familiar senatorial remedy failed to assuage the populace on this occasion. In 92 BC, an aristocratic official, Rutilius Rufus, who had tried to restrain the exactions of the financiers in Asia Minor, was condemned on a charge of corruption so manifestly trumped up that it deceived no one, and in 91 BC, Livius Drusus, a newly elected tribune of the people who was making capital out of the trial of Rutilius Rufus, was assassinated. He had proposed a general enfranchisement of the Italians, and he had foreshadowed not only another land law, but a general abolition of debts. Yet for all this vigour on the part of the senatorial usurers, land-grabbers and forestallers, the hungry and the anxious were still insurgent. The murder of Drusus was the last drop in the popular cup. Italy blazed into a desperate insurrection. There followed 2 years of bitter civil war, the social war. It was a war between the idea of a united Italy and the idea of the rule of the Roman Senate. It was not a social war in the modern sense, but a war between Rome and her Italian allies. Allies, in Latin, is socii. Roman generals, trained in the traditions of colonial warfare, marched ruthlessly up and down Italy, burning farms, sacking towns, and carrying off men, women, and children to sell them in the open market or work them in gangs upon their estate. Marius and an aristocratic general, Sulla, who'd been with him in Africa and who was his bitter rival, both commanded on the side of Rome. But though the insurgents experienced defeats and looting, neither of these generals brought the war to an end. It was ended in a manner in 89 BC by the practical surrender of the Roman Senate to the idea of reform. The spirit was taken out of the insurrection by the concession of their demands in principle, and then, as soon as the rebels had dispersed, the usual cheating of the new voters, by such methods as we've explained in the first section of this chapter, was resumed. By the next year, 88 BC, the old round had begun again. It was mixed up with the personal intrigues of Marius and Sulla against each other. But the struggle had taken on another complexion through the army reforms of Marius, which had created a new type of legionary, a landless professional soldier with no interest in life but pay and plunder, and with no feeling of loyalty except to a successful general. A popular tribune, Sulpicius, was bringing forward some new laws affecting debt, and the consuls were dodging the storm by declaring a suspension of public business. Then came the usual resort to violence, and the followers of Sulpicius drove the consuls from the forum. But here it's that the new forces which the new army had made possible came into play. King Mithridates of Pontus, the Hellenized king of the southern shores of the Black Sea, east of Bithynia, was pressing Rome into war. One of the proposed laws of Sulpicius was that Marius should command the armies sent against this Mithridates, whereupon Sulla marched the army he had commanded throughout the social war to Rome. Marius and Sulpicius fled, and a new age, an age of military pronunciamentos, began. Of how Sulla had himself made commander against Mithridates and departed, and of how legions friendly to Marius then seized power, how Marius returned to Italy and enjoyed a thorough massacre of his political opponents and died, sated of fever, we can't tell in any detail. But one measure during the Marian reign of terror did much to relieve the social tension, and that was the abolition of three-quarters of all outstanding debts. Nor can we tell here how Sulla made a discreditable peace with Mithridates, who had massacred 100,000 Italians in Asia Minor, in order to bring his legions back to Rome, defeat the Marians at the Battle of the Colline Gate of Rome, and reverse the arrangements of Marius. Sulla restored law and order by the proscription and execution of over 5,000 people. He desolated large parts of Italy, restored the Senate to power, repealed many of the recent laws, though he was unable to restore the cancelled burden of debt, and then, feeling bored by politics, and having amassed great riches, he retired with an air of dignity into private life, gave himself up to abominable vices, and so presently died, eaten up with some disgusting disease produced by debauchery. Fourth, political life in Italy wasn't so much tranquillized as stunned by the massacres and confiscations of Marius and Sulla. The scale upon which this history is planned won't permit us to tell here of the great adventurers who, relying more and more on the support of the legions, presently began to scheme and intrigue again for dictatorial power in Rome. In 73 BC, all Italy was terrified by a rising of the slaves, and particularly of the gladiators, led by the gladiator from Thessaly, Spartacus. He and 70 others had fled out from a gladiatorial farm at Capua. Similar risings had already occurred in Sicily. The forces under Spartacus necessarily became a miscellaneous band drawn from east and west without any common idea except the idea of dispersing and getting home. Nevertheless, he held out in southern Italy for 2 years, using the then apparently extinct crater of Vesuvius for a time as a natural fortress. The Italians, for all their love of gladiatorial display, failed to appreciate this conversion of the whole country into an arena, this bringing of the gladiatorial sword to the door, and when at last Spartacus was overthrown, their terror changed to frantic cruelty. 6,000 of his captured followers were crucified. long miles of nailed and drooping victims along the Appian Way. Here we can't deal at any length with Lucullus, who invaded Pontus and fought Mithridates and brought the cultivated cherry tree to Europe. Nor can we tell how ingeniously Pompey the Great stole the triumph and most of the prestige Lucullus had won in Armenia beyond Pontus. Lucullus, like Sulla, retired into an opulent private life, but with more elegance and with a more gracious end. We can't relate in any detail how Julius Caesar accumulated reputation in the West by conquering Gaul, defeating the German tribes upon the Rhine, and pushing a punitive raid across the Straits of Dover into Britain. More and more important grow the legions, less and less significant are the Senate and the assemblies of Rome. But there is a certain grim humour about the story of Crassus that we can't altogether neglect.